Do you remember a time when sleeping on the floor with your friends wouldn't have been considered weird? The management of this website invites you to a new dimension in podcasting, an experience so fun it can only be compared to a childhood sleepover. It's not just about horror.
Tom Atkins proves that any man is leading man material.
It's not just about action.
If you're going to rank Van Damme movies...
Yeah, it's up there.
I'd put it top five.
It's not just about comedy.
There's no other person in the world that loves Weekend at Bernie's more than you.
It's not just about thrillers.
It occurred to me that Cruising is like the most awkward sleepover movie ever.
It's not just about science fiction.
You put your chin to your chest and you're like, you're so nervous. We're all going to die.
It's about nostalgia. Can you survive the Saturday night movie sleepover? It's not a movie. It's a podcast about movies.
You can follow Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at SaturdayNightMovieSleepovers.com on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and just about everywhere you can listen to podcasts.
Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's very special show because I get to talk about Stephen King's It, the monstrously successful adaptation of the author's novel that is breaking records at the box office, and I'm joined for this conversation by a returning guest to the show, the man who wrote the literal book on Stephen King called Beyond Fear, Reflections on Stephen King, Wes Craven, and George Romero's Living Dead. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Joe Madry. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
I'm very excited to have you
Sorry,
back.
Sorry, I wasn't invited for the Silver Bullet episode. What happened there?
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's right. We've talked about Silver Bullet before, right?
I think we did. Yeah, I think we might have on the last podcast, but I was excited to see you jumping into that one.
Yeah, I'm a fan of that movie. So I'm sure we'll end up talking about some other Stephen King adaptations in the process of our discussion of It. I guess I should say right off the top that we will be indulging in spoilers, and that's primarily because this is based on a book that's 30 years old, has already been adapted into a very popular TV miniseries. So if you have never learned the story of It and this new film is going to be your first interaction with it, by all means hold off on listening to this and come back after you see the movie. But it would be pretty impossible to talk about without being able to get into specifics of the plot. So consider yourselves warned. And I guess we'll start. I guess I'll just ask you, Joe, what you thought of the movie.
I was going to add also, it seems like everybody in the free world will have seen this movie after this weekend.
It's pretty incredible. What do you attest that to?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, obviously there's a certain nostalgia factor, and Stephen King's name is as big as or bigger than it ever has been. But you know that you've got like the flip side of the coin this summer too, which is the Dark Tower movie that just tanked. So I'm kind of surprised at the sort of the disparity there and how big this is and how maligned the Dark Tower was. And I certainly went into watching it on Friday with the Dark Tower still kind of in my mind. And I should probably just kind of get this sort of out in the open and confess something. I don't want to kind of disparage either of these films. I think they both work. But I have to say that sitting in the theater for the duration of the film itself, I think I actually enjoyed Dark Tower more than I enjoyed It. And some people will probably just turn off the podcast right now and say, this guy is an idiot, and I'm not going to listen to him anymore. And I don't want to necessarily say that you know, Dark Tower is a better film or anything. I just, you know, for a lot of reasons, it worked for me better. And as I was kind of thinking about, you know, how to approach this topic, how to talk about the new It movie, you know, I kept coming back to this idea that it's kind of impossible to talk about, you know, big releases like this these days, or maybe movies in general, without like setting them up with what do you expect? You know, I think expectations really kind of damned the Dark Tower movie. And I think expectations, what people were expecting, and the fact that it sort of delivered what most people were expecting, has really worked in its favor. Even if you don't watch the trailers or you try to steer clear of the reviews or anything, I think it's impossible to come to these things without expectations that sort of color your experience. And so that's my setup, or sort of my excuse for the big confession I've just made.
I still have not seen The Dark Tower, so I feel terrible. So I can't really weigh in on one versus the other. But I know, you know, it was not a particularly beloved film. So I'm super interested in idea that. Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting that you enjoyed that one more than It. And, you know, we'll get into the reasons why, I'm sure. I tried my very best to go into this without crazy expectations, and I had heard some early word already that it was very good. I have tried to not look at reviews or even, you know, people posting stuff on Facebook. And certainly, you know, this was the book was, I don't know for sure that it was like my way into Stephen King, but I know it was one of the earliest Stephen King books I had ever read. So obviously I have a particularly close relationship with it. And the miniseries meant a lot to me when it aired. I think I was in junior high at that time, and I was cutting out pictures of Pennywise from magazines and posting them in my locker at school. Like, I didn't have athletes or girls in swimsuits. I had Tim Curry in clown makeup. And it was such a big deal that it felt like this event. And nobody else in my house really cared about it, but it meant everything to me. And I recognize that the miniseries is very flawed. Although I think it's interesting how much, and I guess I'll ask what your take is on the miniseries, but with this new movie out, it seems like you almost can't praise the new movie without shitting on the miniseries.
Yeah.
And I don't think that needs to happen, even if you didn't like the miniseries. I don't think it's necessary to. You have to recognize the limitations of the format that they were working in, you know, in a big way. What are your feelings about the miniseries that aired in, 1990, I think?
Yeah, well, certainly it was. I mean, you're right about the restrictions that they had. I think the biggest one was you're not. You know, they got this from standards and practices, this rule, you're not allowed to show children in mortal jeopardy. Well, there goes the movie, you know, I mean, forget it. That's, you know, and I think, you know, the violence certainly in the new one felt real. I mean, I guess, you know, I'll go ahead and kind of jump in that the thing, you know, right off the bat, that opening scene, with where Georgie, which has been in the trailers, that's not, I guess, not a big spoiler, but with, you know, Georgie, you know, sailing the boat down the street, and then Pennywise is down in the drain. And it's what they show. It's very faithful to how it's described in the book, and it's pretty brutal. I mean, that first scene, you know, I mean, you and I both have young children, and, you know, when you have a scene that opens a movie where a young child, you know, gets attacked and turns around and his arm is gone.
Yeah.
That hit me. And that obviously was not something they could come anywhere close to doing in the miniseries. And so the miniseries, you know, it feels a little bit soft. They had a lot, you know, the development history of that miniseries is really interesting because, you know, of course, it started out Romero was going to do it. Lawrence D. Cohen, who's, I think, one of the best adapters of Stephen King's work to the screen, wrote multiple screenplays, and it was originally going to be a 10-hour miniseries, and then it got chopped down to 8, and then it got chopped down to 6. When it got chopped down to 4, George Romero bailed. And, you know, it's a lot to juggle. It's a huge story. I think the fact that the miniseries, and that probably a lot of the audience is going to see the new movie are familiar with the miniseries, that it's in that two-part format where it's the kids in the first and the adults in the second, you know, certainly that is comparable, and it's almost kind of delivering what people are nostalgic about, but ratcheting up what they can do, you know, ratcheting up the violence. You know, certainly they ratcheted up the language is comparable to King's book.
Yeah, right.
Like what it made me think about, like there's been a lot of comparisons to the Goonies, you know, and like what Spielberg, you know, was kind of doing in the mid 80s where all the, you know, all the children of the 80s in his movies are just like talking smack all the time. and there's a lot of that, you know, in the new movie, and there, you know, there wasn't, the kids are sort of more innocent, I guess, if you want to say that, in the, you know, in the miniseries, and not so much in the novel, but yeah, I don't know what I'm just kind of rambling. There's so many directions I could go in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting, you know, and I know why they made the change from the late 50s to, you know, the late 80s. And it's really so that part two can take place in contemporary times.
Right. And it's targeting us as an audience that's nostalgic about the story.
Right.
You know, it's like you turn your, you know, Henry Bowers and, you know, like to turn the Mean Kids into, you know, mullet wearing rednecks instead of, you know, 50s greasers in their leather jackets. You know, I mean, that's, it resonates for us as a generation.
Right.
And 80, even, I feel like even audiences younger than us, it kind of resonates, because my feeling is kind of like even millennials who weren't alive in the 80s are sort of nostalgic about the 80s.
Well, yeah, look at the success of something like Stranger Things, you know. There's a strange nostalgia for a time where people weren't even necessarily alive. I feel like that choice to move it up to the 80s and obviously just changing some of the language, I do think it helps combat one of the issues that I think the miniseries was up against, partially because it was for TV and partially because they went period specific. And that is, I think it helps combat a little bit of Stephen King's natural affinity for corniness.
Yeah.
He can be a little bit corny sometimes, and especially when he's writing period, some of the language that the characters use and some of their little colloquial expressions and stuff. And I don't know that that would fly for, you know, a mainstream Hollywood movie today. I think it would confuse a lot of people. And so I think that that is one change that helped the film.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. I was sort of watching it thinking, okay, I was reading the book, around the time that this movie, the new movie is set.
Yeah.
And like try, you know, try to remember what life was like at that time. You really can't accurately, but kind of going, oh, you know, did we talk like this, you know, in 1988? I don't think so, but I don't really remember. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
You know, some of Richie's dialogue about some of the sex stuff and some of the your mom stuff, I don't remember talking like that, but maybe I just hadn't read enough Stephen King yet.
Yeah, well, definitely Stephen. I mean, I remember, like, I read it in sixth grade. And the, you know, I definitely remember not only the violence, but kind of the language, the way those kids talked, surprising me, you know, I don't think I was talking like that, but it also is kind of part of his story that these are, you know, the kind of the kids from the wrong side of the tracks. Right. And so he was maybe, you know, as an author kind of pushing that button a little too hard, or maybe not. Maybe that is how, you know, when Stephen King was growing up, that was how he and the kids he knew talked. I don't know. But, you know, some of the, you know, it's sort of weird watching something that is playing, you know, like more than I think of a lot of horror movies these days is playing right to kind of our generation. And yet there were some things in there that that felt almost like they were too obvious, or they were sort of like cheap shots at evoking nostalgia. Like the marquee kept changing
at the
movie theater. And, you know, I felt like there were a couple of scenes where I sort of went, oh, it feels like it's sort of ripped right out of an 80s, like the Patrick Hockstetter when he's in the sewer doing the like hairspray and lighter thing.
Right.
I mean, just the way that scene played out, it felt like, you know, the tunnels in Aliens. And so I was watching it very kind of mindful of like, oh, I feel like this is, you know, sort of our generation wrote this adaptation. And so they're kind of hitting all these buttons. There was another one that, I guess it was the thing with Beverly and the hair coming out of the drain, which was an interesting variation, I thought, on the scene that's in the book and in the miniseries. But I was watching it going, oh, it's Poltergeist 2, you know, right. Except with hair. And so it was like, I felt it, you know, and there's something about that that's kind of cool, but it also kind of pulls me out a little bit. Like, you know, but I don't know if other people were that kind of conscious of homages, or maybe it doesn't, you know, doesn't pull other people out the way it pulls me out.
I don't think it pulled me out. And I think in some ways I was almost appreciative of some level of restraint, because I've just seen so many period movies that go out of their way. Even Atomic Blonde earlier this summer would just go out of its way every 10 minutes to have, and here's a new 80s new wave song. And there were a few of those on the soundtrack, but it wasn't anything that was like overly obnoxious.
Yeah, they weren't that obnoxious. Except for the New Kids on the Block stuff, which I thought was incredibly obnoxious.
It was strange. It was strange. I didn't mind the conversations about it, and I thought some of the dialogue was okay, but the bit with the poster on the door was such an overtly comic moment, which isn't bad, but just even the way that it was edited, I thought, well, that was out of step with the rest of the movie.
Yeah. It's another one of these things where you think back and you sort of, I mean, I guess this is going to illustrate, I guess, the point of the scene, but it's like, I was thinking back going, did the guys ever really like New Kids on the Block? That was pretty much always the girls.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Not like guys had, you know, better taste. I mean, I like, you know, Milli Vanilli, which is not like that's a better act, but you know, New Kids on the Block, I was kind of going, wait a minute, that's, Weren't the writers around for the 80s? They know the guys didn't really like New Kids
on
the Block.
Right. So. Although I did, I sort of liked it as an early. It creates an instant connection between Bev and Ben in terms of like they have this secret that they share, and it's an innocuous secret, but I liked it as sort of a shortcut for that character beat.
Well, that she chooses not to embarrass him
right
in front of the others. Yeah, right. So you're right, that's a good connection. I actually think that Beverly was by far the best developed character in the movie.
I
thought the actress's performance was great, and she was both the most vulnerable of all the kids in the movie and also the strongest, which was amazing. I mean, I this could almost sort of initiate a separate discussion about what, you know, why is it that the only female character is so much more developed and interesting, and that they can make her both more vulnerable and stronger than the other characters. I mean, her character really, really, you know, resonated for me. And I think, you know, the only other one maybe that came close was Bill in the moments with his brother. I thought, you know, any scene that Georgie was in was pretty, pretty powerful.
They have a scene near the end of the film that I was, I did not handle that well in the sewer at the end.
That was real. And it was surprising because they didn't do the obvious thing. And I did really like that. I mean, on the whole, I'd have to say that third act, there were a lot of places where there could have been pitfalls where it could have been, oh, come on. And I thought they did a really good job with that. And so, you know, it's a movie. A friend of mine has this tendency to say, well, there's two there's two parts to, there's two parts to every movie. There's everything that leads up to the end and the end, you know, and it's yeah, like, right. If you can get right and send people out on a good note, then you're golden. And I thought they ended it really well.
I think it works as its own movie, even if they were never going to do a part two. I appreciate that it doesn't end and it's like, okay, see you in a couple of years. Obviously yeah. It says, you know, chapter one, and we know having read the book where it goes, but it is its own complete story.
Yeah. And I loved that. I thought somebody had told me who saw it a few weeks ago that it had a wraparound with the adults. And I don't know why I believe that. I mean, you can go on IMDb and see that there's no adults in the cast, but I love that it was self-contained. I really hope that chapter two is self-contained with just the adults. I think it would be really easy to go to flashbacks, and I kind of hope they don't go to flashbacks. Yeah. That they sort of give the adults that same chance to have their own story. I don't know how likely that is to happen.
Right. But, well, especially with the popularity of this, I feel like somebody's going to be saying, right. "Hey, can't we work in that thing that everybody liked?"
Right, because it's like a safety valve. It's right. You know, people already like these kids and these actors, so we shouldn't shoot ourselves in the foot if we can kind of get some goodwill out of bringing them back.
I worry too that I feel like the second half, the adult half, and this is kind of the miniseries kind of bears this out, is harder to do.
Yeah,
I think they have their work cut out for them to make the adult movie as effective and as successful as this one was. Which I guess we haven't even really talked about what we thought about the movie. we're getting into specifics. Loved it. I mean, I know you said you enjoyed it, not as much as The Dark Tower, but you enjoyed it. I think that I maybe wasn't as aware of certain buttons being pushed on me as you were in terms of being mm-hmm. taken out of the movie at times, but I think I just enjoyed having those buttons pushed so much. I guess I'm just like the mark for this movie, unfortunately, but I was pretty much in from the beginning, and I really, really, really liked it.
Yeah, I truly don't want to get negative about it. I feel like a jerk being at all negative about it. I never negative about any film because I think that's sort of pointless, but you know, I think it's about expectations. Like if I had to sum up, my reservations, it would be, what's his name? Cary Fukunaga, who did True Detective,
yeah.
whose name is still on it as a screenwriter, but that he was going to direct. And I thought, my God, are we going to get a True Detective style adaptation of It?
Yeah.
Which to me would be slow and subtle and sophisticated and mysterious and just kind of drawn like a creeping fear kind of adaptation. And as soon as they planted that idea in my mind, that's what I wanted. And that's not what this is.
Right.
And maybe that's why he left, that there were, people wanted to go another way. I think the film that came out that exists is much more of a crowd pleaser. I think from a commercial standpoint, they were smart to do what they did. But, to me, it's just a like, that's not what I got in my head stylistically. And, like I got excited about the idea of something that was a little more subtle and kind of what they did, especially in the scare scenes. I mean, it's crafted. They know how to, they know how to craft the shocks and how to build to a jump scare. The editing to me in a lot of the scare scenes was really kind of overkill, like the herky jerky, jump frames to the clown's right. face as he rushes at you, all that kind of stuff. But that's, I also was talking to my friend about this yesterday who just like you, he loved it. And I just said, we're the same age, but I just said, I don't know, I guess I'm like, I'm having like an old guy moment. In that, because it's like that seems to work for everybody, and for me, I'm kind of like, oh, I see what you're doing there, but all the sort of jerkiness and this sort of assault, the sensory assault, play the music really loud, and and, you know, have this kind of fragmented editing and make everything happen really fast, it's great for like a jump scare kind of thing, because I love the book so much, and there's such a kind of slow burn quality, at least to kind of, well, really to the whole book, I would say. You know, I was looking for something that I went out of the theater kind of having, you know, just like nervousness in my gut, you know, that really left me feeling unsettled. But I don't think that, you know, this was a roller coaster ride movie. This was fun. And, you know, it's kind of a shame that I was so desperate to be genuinely scared that I maybe didn't have as much fun as I should have. Maybe sure. I'll go watch it a second and go, I'm just going to go in and have fun and it'll all be fine. I think my expectations maybe messed up the experience for me. So sure. I'm sure I will watch it again.
I don't mind a few of those scares that you're talking about, but I 100% agree that it did become just repetitive. It felt like the same beat, particularly in, like, I guess it would be the second act, where each kid starts to have a separate encounter with Pennywise or some variation on Pennywise, and it really did feel like kind of, and then there's this freaky thing that gets up in their face and chases them, and I do wish that some of the scares had been a little bit more patient and taken their time. You know, there was a shot, one of the freakiest shots in the movie for me happens right up front, and it's right after Georgie has his arm ripped off, and it's that great overhead shot of as Georgie crawls away and Pennywise's arm stretches really long out of the drain, and I kind of wanted more stuff like that, just images where it's just, it's not a jump scare, it's just something that you're looking at and you just think, well, that's not right, that there's something off about that, because you're right, the book is so much about feeling dread, and it's the things that kids dread, it's the dread of this thing returning every 27 years, and I like that the movie still deals a lot with fears, whether it's childhood fears or the fears that we have as adults. It just approaches fear in a much more kind of visceral, something jumping out of the closet way, and not so much that sense of dread that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because I had actually forgotten that shot. And you know, now that you bring it up, I remember watching that and thinking, oh, it is an homage moment, because it's the Freddy arm, you know, when he's in the alleyway chasing Tina at the beginning of Elm Street. But they didn't hit it so hard. They showed enough of it that you realized that's what was happening, and then they cut away.
Right.
And so that worked for me as an homage moment. I went, oh, it's Elm Street. And then they went away from it, and it completely worked for me, because they didn't kind of overkill it. Like, hey, guys, look, do you get it? Do you get it? You know, that totally worked for me. I mean, you're right. That was a really effective scene. And some of the stuff some of the scare scenes later in the film that I would still kind of classify as maybe overkill, but the overkill worked for me in some cases, like the what in the book is a scrapbook scene and in the new movie is a slide projector scene. You know, that's a whole sequence that's built where each little scare is constantly, you know, topping itself. And the finale of that sequence, I thought, wow, I didn't see that coming, and really, they went all out, and I was like, hey, good for them. They pulled that off. I thought they were done at a certain point, and they went to the next step, and I went, okay, that I'm impressed.
Yeah, that's the one I think that had me laughing in the theater, because I had the exact same response, where I was like, okay, that was fine, that was fun, and then it goes to the next even bigger thing, and I was laughing out loud.
Holy shit! and I remember that one, and then the one, God, we really are giving spoilers. I feel horrible.
Well, that's
giving
okay.
Spoilers.
Like I said at the beginning, we were going to be talking about spoilers, so it's all right.
Like Beverly, when Beverly gets taken, kind of setting up the big showdown at the end in the bathroom scene, that really worked for me, because I didn't see that, because it's already a pretty intense scene. And in the book, and in the miniseries, that doesn't happen. You know, she doesn't get taken. And that was a twist where I thought, wow, that's smart. They know that their audience, or at least a large portion of their audience, knows the story already. So it worked on a storytelling level to change it up. And also just as you know, purely in terms of how they, the geography of the scene and how they shot it, the shock reveal worked. So yeah, there were a lot of things. I mean, it's funny talking about it because I'm partly like, well, why do I start off on a negative note? There were a lot of things that worked, but it's just, there was so much going on. There's so much to unpack.
Yeah.
And I think one of the other things I was thinking at a certain point in, you know, in the movie, and this shows that I'm maybe not in the movie as much as I should, but I was thinking about 1408, you know, and how to me this was kind of like a 1408 Stephen King adaptation. Now, 1408 was a crowd pleaser. It made a ton of money. People love it. But to me, it was just like throw everything at the wall. Some of it's going to stick.
Yeah.
And I want more confidence in the filmmakers where it's just like, we're going to choose our moments and we're going to really pick these moments and build these moments. And I guess I'm just not a fan of the throw everything at the wall and see what sticks approach, you know, that I, you know, some of it absolutely works. Some of it's great. And then some of it doesn't work. And the some of it that doesn't work, maybe other people are just kind of, you shrug that off because there's so much that does work. But I kind of look at it and I'm just going, you know, you've packed so much into the movie. And I would get pulled in a little more if you could slow it down a little bit and pull me in a little bit more and do slower builds to the scares. Right. But you know, again, maybe this is just me being old. I don't know.
Hey everybody, Patrick here from F This Movie. Are you listening to the Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers podcast yet? If not, what are you, some kind of a monster? If you're a fan of F This Movie, of course you're going to love Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. You remember Blake from being on our show. He was on the Silver Bullet episode with me. He was on to talk about his book, Scored to Death. Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers is a podcast devoted to talking about the kinds of movies that many of us 80s kids grew up loving and watching during sleepovers. Movies like The Terminator, movies like The Breakfast Club, movies like The Neverending Story or Monster Squad, or Night of the Creeps. Guess what? These are all movies that have been talked about on Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. It's hosted by friends Blake and Dion, and it is a lot like our show in the way that it is a really fun and relaxed conversation about the kinds of movies that we love. October's coming up. They are doing episodes every week on horror films. This year, they've done a whole series on 1987 movies, talking about, you know, RoboCop and Predator and The Lost Boys, all the kinds of kick-ass movies that you remember watching at sleepovers growing up. It is fun. It's funny. It's nostalgic. It's informative when they talk about these movies. It's just a really, really fun show. And I know a lot of you have been turned on to the show from us talking about it here. Some of you may have been turned on to our show from hearing about it over there. So, you know, it's great to have friends in the podcast community, and it's great to be friends with podcasts that you really like. And I'm happy to tell you all to listen to Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. You could check them out at SaturdayNightMovieSleepovers.com. They have a really active Facebook group, so make sure you check them out on Facebook and on Twitter. Blake also has a new podcast that he's co-hosting with Mike Vanderbilt from Daily Grindhouse called 21 Pod Street, the first and I believe only podcast that's devoted entirely to 21 Jump Street, which is awesome. But make sure you check out Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. There's episodes on Commando, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and Teen Wolf. I was the guest on the Teen Wolf episode, and it was super fun, and I think you guys should all listen to it. Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, it's like a sleepover for your ears. You mentioned the scene where Bev gets taken, and it is a well-done scene, and it works, I think, in terms of the construction of the film that they wrote and directed. I will confess that that was a moment where I felt myself deflating a little bit in my seat, because I just felt, like you, that Bev was easily the best character in the movie and the most interesting and probably my favorite performance, and really elevated the movie whenever she was on screen. I think it becomes about something greater than just, hey, kids, we're kids, and there's something scary.
Right.
And so when she got taken, I was like, really? The one girl has to be rescued? You know, it's, I don't know. I don't know who they could have, swapped her out with, because she is so important. And it does feel like, yes, of course, they would all then come back together and we got to go get Bev. Not that they would have let another friend behind, but it doesn't feel as urgent as when it's Bev. But at the same time, I just was so bummed out that the one girl who, as you said, is the strongest character in the film has to be rescued by all the boys.
Yeah, I get it. It's like a cheap shot. While I was watching it, I was thinking, of course it has to be her, you know, again, because she's both the most vulnerable character because of the situation with her father. And I guess, I mean, you know, I guess you could say, well, that, you know, her, she's vulnerable, you know, but it's a situation that exists because she's a girl, but it's really not. I mean, you know, like, boys have abusive fathers.
Right.
And so I just feel like I was kind of watching it going, she's got to be the one who's taken, not because she's a girl, but because she's both the most vulnerable and the strongest. Like, she's the one who, it's like, if Pennywise can take Bev, oh, they're kind of fucked, you know?
Right,
She's the one who attacked, like, at least twice in the movie, like the two big physical assaults on Pennywise, she leads the charge.
Yeah.
You know, in the book and the miniseries, it's Bill. Bill is the leader of that group. Well, in this movie, Bev is the leader of that group. And so that, I suppose I was watching it from that perspective going, yeah, she has to be the one taken, because if it were, you know, the book or the movie, it would be the same as Bill being taken.
Right.
You know, it gives everybody else a moment to go, oh, wait a minute, maybe we can't fight this. Like, we just lost our leader, you know, sort of thing. So I guess that's how it, you know, it resonated for me.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, it does still work within the context of the film. There's just that little part of me that just, the same way that they kind of sideline Mike Hanlon, where it's 2017 and you're like, hey, guys, let's be better about certain things, you know, let's have a little bit more awareness, yes, of certain tropes.
What? I mean, even from a storytelling perspective on Mike, it's just like, let's be aware of the fact that at least if they're going to follow, you know, the pre-existing story in the novel and the miniseries, he is the one, he is the character who brings everybody back,
right,
and who stays scary and who keeps, you know, keeps the home fires lit,
right,
kind of thing. So he's a hugely important character. And yeah, I thought they didn't do enough with him to kind of hit his importance as a character. But, you know, I mean, I guess some things like that were bound to fall through the cracks just to not have a 4-hour movie. Everybody, you know, not like to take it back to the Dark Tower, but everybody kind of, the reaction of the Dark Tower was, you know, this should have been an epic TV series and you tried to do it in 95 minutes. I actually would have loved if the new It were a TV series and each, you know, you could do a 1-hour episode, each 1-hour episode for a while developed individual characters.
Right.
I think the material and the actors, you know, are good enough to support that. And then it would have allowed the slow build that I would have liked to see. So this is crazy. Like, now I'm sitting here having the reaction to It that everybody else has had to the Dark Tower. that nobody's having that reaction to it that I've heard. So,
right. Well, as you said, it's such a crowd pleaser, you know. You had mentioned earlier the scene with the hair coming out of the drain. That was one of the changes that I really, really liked. And again, I don't even know that I was conscious of it as a Poltergeist 2 reference, but I think I just liked it again because I felt like there were times when the filmmakers were consciously trying to play into not just generalized childhood fears like clowns. I mean, Richie's throwaway, I'm afraid of clowns, like, okay, great. But very specific fears in the way they set up what the hair represents, and then for that to be coming out of the drain kind of back to haunt her, I thought,
yeah,
was an example of a very smart change.
Yeah, no, you're right. I actually hadn't. You're absolutely right. I hadn't thought about that as her having long hair represents and the revenge of that in a way. But you're absolutely right. It's smart writing, and it's something that I missed sitting there watching it. So
yeah.
Good job.
Well, thank you. There were, again, there are, you know, there are, I found enough examples of things like that, that I am, just as you had said, you know, there are people who enjoyed enough stuff that they can overlook some of the, right. missteps. And I think that's kind of the camp that I'm in, where I'm latching on to certain moments, certain shots, certain performances, certain relationships. And so I can overlook, you know, some of the things that I'm like, all right, well, that was a little easy, or that felt a little rushed, or, you know, like I said, that, that middle act feels kind of repetitive. I thought it was interesting the role that the parents played in the film, because I feel like in the miniseries we didn't see much of anyone's parents, and we don't meet everyone's parents in this. I don't think we ever met Ben's parents, and we never met Richie's parents, but everyone else has that relationship with their parents where they are sort of afraid of them, and they're afraid of them in different ways. Right. But again, I thought that was a nice way of acknowledging, of making the movie actually be about fear and what it feels like to be afraid and what fear does to us, instead of just a movie about this clown that's trying to eat you. I appreciated that it was, it tried to be about something larger in the way that the book tries to be about that as well.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely in the book and not so much in the miniseries. And I think it's because, you know, childhood fear to a large degree is about feeling powerless.
Yeah.
You know, you're too small to, and there's, you know, adults are controlling your life. Yeah, it's definitely in the book. I think, you know, Stephen King has talked about sort of choosing, Bangor. I mean, he calls it, you know, there, it's set in Derry, right. Maine, but basically it's Bangor, you know, or was in his mind that he was kind of basing it on Bangor. The geographies are the same. I remember like this story where he said that he realized he wanted to set the story there, that that was the right setting for the story he had in mind. When there was a murder, or I don't know, he didn't classify it as a murder, an accidental death, but basically a hate crime in the early 80s, like maybe 1980, 81. It may have actually been later than that, because he worked on this book for years. I think it was later. I think it was 84. In the summer of 84, that there were kind of there was a big festival in Bangor in the summer, and that this group of guys who I think were college age saw a gay couple, two men coming out of a bar, and they are, you know, going in. They saw the two guys together going in, and then one guy came out alone or something. They chased the one guy and threw him into the canal there in Bangor. And the canal is, it's not that it's that deep, but this guy couldn't swim, and it just goes on and on, and there's no outlet. So it's just these really tall walls, and there's no way to climb up or get out, and the guy drowned. And so it's this horrible crime that was kind of a taint on the town for a while, like, you know, not that you know, he just had this sense of Bangor as kind of a blue collar town where people can allow things to happen. Why couldn't, you know, this guy must have been screaming. Why didn't anybody help him? Why didn't anybody get him out? And so, you know, there's a little bit of that in the book, that he said that's when I realized I wanted to set it there. And it's, you know, it's there in the new movie from the very beginning. I mean, there's like the old lady and her cat, who don't really watch Georgie get attacked and die, but are, you know, I mean, you kind of can't tell how much she sees. The cat sees everything,
right?
But you can't tell how much the lady sees and if she's going along with it. And then there's, you know, then there's the scene later where Henry Bowers and his company are like, Henry's carving his name on Ben's stomach.
Yeah.
You know, which is pretty, you know, overtly violent. And you see this car go by, and people are, you know, just this old couple are just sort of looking out the window casually, maybe glaring a little bit, but they're not going to get involved.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, that's a note. I think if you're going to do a story about childhood fear, you sort of have to hit that note that, you know, that if adults sort of control your life and they're responsible for your safety, what the hell happens if they won't step in, if they won't protect you, or if they can't protect you and they know they can't protect you, you know, what have you got? Where does your power come from? And right. This is a whole story. How your power comes from, you know, from friends, from, you know, the power of a group of people who are looking out for each other and loving each other. You know, that's why it works. And I think, like, to go back to the ending, I think that's why the ending works, is they really knew that that's what this story had to be about.
What was your take on Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise? I feel like that was one of those, you know, far too easy measures, but it was one of those things that I feel like so much was riding on that in terms of whether or not people accepted this movie, was if they got that aspect of it right, because if they didn't, I feel like everybody would have turned on it pretty quick.
Yeah, I've had, you know, it's funny because it's weird that, what are we, like, you know, 45 minutes into this conversation? I can't believe it's taken this long to get to this one. But this is like front and center. You're right. It should be the kind of the make or break thing. And I think, you know, Tim Curry as Pennywise was probably the biggest strength of the miniseries.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's actually come up first in a lot of conversations I've been having with people, you know, the last 2 days. What did you think about the movie? And, you know, I remember two reactions. One person sort of said, well, you know, it's not as good as Tim Curry, but it, you know, it's different and interesting. So fine. You know, kind of a, like, they, you know, they passed, maybe not with flying colors, but they passed. And, you know, and then another friend said, you know, Pennywise was the least interesting thing about the new movie. And yet it didn't sink. He liked it. It didn't sink the movie for him at all. I kind of agree with the, you know, it gets a pass.
Yeah.
Response. You know, I'm glad that they didn't just try to do an imitation of Tim Curry doing Pennywise, this sort of like crazy drunken hobo version of a clown who, you know, I mean, that would have been, I think, a problem for me if they had just done that. So I like that it's different. It's the smile is creepy. The look is creepy. Like as an image, I thought it was creepy. There were a couple of things that, you know, like he's got these like big long buck teeth and he's kind of talking with a lisp. And at some point, like that very first scene where he pops up, I'm kind of going, it's creepy, but there's something about it that just makes me feel like what I'm watching, sort of, like, instead of the drunk hobo version of Pennywise, I'm kind of watching the Hills Have Eyes version of Pennywise. Like, he's sort of like an inbred mutant version of Pennywise. And, you know, it's fine. They went a different direction with it. And like I said, it's kind of creepy as an image. It never completely won me over. But, you know, that being the strength of the miniseries, I feel like that was, you know, it's the like big shoes to fill clown joke. You know, they were never probably going to completely pull that off, but it doesn't, you know, that certainly, you know, for as much as I've complained about nitpick little things in the movie, that was never off-putting. His performance was certainly never off-putting.
It was an adjustment for me in the first scene, because I have seen the miniseries a bunch of times. I recorded it off of VHS, you know, in 1990, and sat there and cut out the commercials. And so I would just watch it over and over again. So it's one of those things that I haven't seen it in a long time, but it's pretty ingrained in my memory. So I know the dialogue pretty well. And in that first scene with Georgie, it was certainly an adjustment, because it's a situation that I recognized. The dialogue was pretty familiar, and yet it's not Tim Curry doing it in his voice. It's this other weird thing. And so yeah, there was a little bit of a learning curve for me where I was like, I don't know how I feel about this.
Right.
But once I got past, and it's not that scene is bad, it just was different and I had to adjust. Once I got past that scene, I really didn't even think about Tim Curry anymore, which isn't to say like this guy owns Pennywise now, just that it is different. And I felt like it became its own thing. But really, I think one of the choices that they made that was kind of smart was, as you had said, the miniseries really has Tim Curry going for it more than anything. And he becomes the thing that the kids are afraid of. So, of course, he needs to be scary, and he stands out in all of our brains, and he's the thing that got so many people afraid of clowns, you know, people our age. Pennywise in this version isn't necessarily the thing that they're afraid of. He represents the things that they are afraid of, and so the actual Pennywise character almost takes a little bit of a back seat, which I think is a smart choice. I think his screen time is actually somewhat limited, especially in comparison to the Tim Curry iteration. And so, yeah, I'm not like, oh my gosh, it's a home run. It's not the Heath Ledger Joker where you're like, oh, it redefines everything, but it works enough, and they use the character well enough that, yeah, I didn't have any problems with it.
I think maybe this goes back to like kind of the problem I had with the editing in the scare scenes, in that they never sort of linger on his performance as Pennywise, as the thing that's scary. You know, they're always going to the jump and him rushing at you, right, screaming and crazy herky jerky editing and crank the volume all the way up. And you know, when you think about like why clowns are scary, okay, for our generation, I feel like they just accepted that with this new movie and just said, everybody's scared of clowns. All you have to do is show them a clown. The clown's coming at him. We're good. And in a way, like what's scary about Tim Curry is, or clowns in general, I suppose, is just like they're dressed up and they're supposed to be completely kid oriented and non-threatening and fun and, you know, whatever. And then what happens if you put, you know, John Wayne Gacy in that
right,
that makeup? We grew up, you know, hearing the stories about John Wayne Gacy. And that's, you know, again, it's like if you just sort of, you know, if they would have in the new movie just sort of let him be a creepy clown, you know, like kind of, I guess they do it in the first scene. I mean, maybe that's why the scene with Georgie really works for me, is that he's luring him in and he's saying all the right things and do you smell the popcorn, and, you know, and he's, and this kid's kind of going, I can't tell if, you know, I just, right. He's saying the right things and he's smiling and he seems, you know, he's not going into that scene already afraid of clowns the way a lot of us are going into this movie, maybe already afraid of clowns. And so, you know, I just, you know, kind of to allow his mannerisms and his delivery and his performance be the thing that's scary, instead of having to throw him at the screen and chop up the editing and crank the volume, to me is like, would have been kind of creepier. You know, again, it's like that, if they had done the True Detective version of a killer clown,
right,
I would have been, you know, I just think that would have been scarier. Maybe it would have been less fun, but it would have been scarier.
Well, the approach they take with the noise and the editing would make anything scary. You know, if it was a bunny or something, if you add that sound effect and edit it that way, it's going to be scary. So there is a disconnect there where it's not really drawing on the idea of this being a clown. One of my favorite scenes with him actually is like his last scene, really, where he starts to bargain with the kids.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting and really effective, where, you know, you see almost another side of this thing. And maybe it was because it allowed Bill Skarsgård to give a slightly different performance where he's not just taunting them or trying to freak them out. Now he's this other thing that is starting to feel desperate and afraid. And I thought that was a really interesting moment.
Yeah. The kids got a real moment of power there, which I think is great. You know, I love that. I can't remember what the dialogue, I think, you know, Bill delivers something about how, you know, now you're afraid of us, you know, we're the ones in power. And I like that. I really like that as a moment. And then it was more, you know, I think it's more overt than in the mini series, where it kind of feels like, whew, got away.
You know? Right.
You know, like, and I guess that's partly because of having broken it up and this being a standalone, but it's there in the book, you know, this idea of empowering kids. And so I think that was sort of what really worked for me, you know, even more than kind of, you know, seeing it from Pennywise's side. One thing I did wonder was, like, the way that Pennywise expresses fear in that moment is by repeating Bill's mnemonic device, yeah. that like he thrusts his fist against the post. One thing I wondered is like, we know what that is because we grew up with the book and the miniseries, and I just, and it's also in Salem's Lot as the thing that you say to try to work through your fear.
Right.
In those stories, that's the function it serves. And I wonder, like, you know, younger audiences or people who are coming to this story for the first time who haven't read the book or who haven't seen the miniseries, when Bill's doing it earlier in the film and then when Pennywise does it, do they know, do they go, what the hell's up with that phrase? Because they never, like, introduce it in the movie as a mnemonic device to help him with his stuttering, do they?
No.
In the new movie. I just, like, it's a weird thing where I'm kind of wondering, like, wow, does that, is that a, like, what the hell moment for people coming to it fresh? You know, there were a couple things like that where I was like, oh, you're assuming that your audience knows this and moving through it really, really quickly. I mean, you know, which is hard when you know something so intimately and you're right. in there kind of editing it down. But it was just a weird moment where I sort of went, oh, I don't know, will that big moment at the end with Pennywise turning that phrase around and using it, will that resonate for people who kind of don't have, you know, aren't kind of coming in with all the, you know, knowing all the backstory.
Right.
I can't answer that because I'm, you know, I've been obsessed since I was with this story since I was. So.
I wonder too, if this is the kind of situation where if they really nail part two, and again, I hope that they do, do you think it will make part one better in retrospect? Like, if they figure out a way to pay off, you know, if they really pay off that he thrusts his fist against the post thing, does that moment then in part one become kind of great? Whereas right now it's kind of like, well, I don't know. You're just throwing that in there because it's from the book or whatever. But if they figure out a way to sort of thread that through into the second one, does it then make aspects of the first movie better?
You know, you were talking about how the second movie doing the story with the adults is so much harder. And I think a lot of the strengths of the of part one, this new part one, is that nostalgia factor and is the kind of getting into the mindset of being a kid and what friendship is like at that age and what fear is like at that age and how excited you are about different things, you know, the newness, experience of newness, new discoveries and all this. And you kind of don't have that. I mean, even within the story, the adult story in the novel, the adults don't really remember at first. They first come back to Derry. They don't remember all that. And it's kind of like they have to like dig up sort of repressed, buried memories and learn kind of how to re-experience thinking like a kid.
Yeah.
And so that's what the filmmakers have to do too. I mean, the thing they have to convey, like they have to get us into that mindset while we're looking at the adults. I mean, they got, like, you know, for you and I, and for our generation, we're adults, we have kids, and we can get into that mindset by watching chapter one and kind of living vicariously through those kids and their experience. But how do you bring sort of that magic, that kind of like the emotion of nostalgia to the story of the adults? How do you kind of reawaken the adults as characters in the movie in a way that's also going to, you know, get us into the same mindset that we have watching chapter one? That's hard. I mean, that's going to be hard, you know, and not to fall back on the cheap, you know, let's just do a bunch of flashbacks.
Right. I think you're absolutely right that I worry that that's something that they're going to indulge as kind of a shortcut to do exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, because tonally, part two has to be so different. And chapter one gets away with that whole kind of kids on bikes mentality, and some of the score evokes, you know, kind of those Spielberg 80s movies. And I think it works for this movie, but you can't do that in chapter two, because it's so much about, you know, this movie isn't as much about being a kid in the moment as it is sort of remembering what it's like to be a kid. And and so chapter two, when it's dealing with adulthood, has its work cut out for it. Let me ask you this. one of the things I liked about the movie and that I responded to so much about the movie is something that I've responded to in other, you know, imperfect movies. I remember when I saw Wonder Woman, I was like, well, that has a lot of problems, but I think it got the spirit of the thing right. And so watching this new It, I thought, well, okay, it has some issues, but I really love it because it gets the spirit of the thing right. And now I'm starting to doubt myself because I'm wondering, does it actually get the spirit of King right? Or does it get what I'm remembering the spirit of King to be right? Do you know what I mean? Like, I've seen King's work.
Am I distilled. This movie for Patrick?
I've seen his work distilled through so many adaptations that I'm wondering if I'm confusing his actual text with all of the adaptations of his text that make me feel a certain way. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are moments in this movie that recall all the stuff I love about Silver Bullet, to bring that back.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
But is it faithful to the book, or is it just faithful to the feeling I get of watching stuff like Stand By Me and Silver Bullet?
Yeah, I mean, this is like one of the big questions about anybody who starts talking about the film adaptations of Stephen King is like, how faithful do you need to be to the text? And, you know, a lot of people say, well, we're deviating from the text, but we're going to be true to the spirit.
Right.
You know, and that's fine. I mean, I actually have no problem. Stephen King has flat out said he has no problem with people deviating from the text. You know, but then it's like, what is the spirit of Stephen King? You know,
exactly.
It's like an easy thing to say in an interview. I just made a Stephen King adaptation, so I know I have to go in the interview and be like, I've been true to the spirit of Stephen King because I'm a big fan of blah, blah, blah. Well, what the fuck is this, you know, the spirit? Like, what does that mean?
Right.
And it's like hard to it's funny because I just did an interview with our mutual friend Rob Galuzzo a couple of days ago about this, and like, this is one of the things he asked me. And, you know, I think one way we got into it is he said, well, you know, what movie do you think best distills the voice of Stephen King? And that's one way to look at it. Like, what captures the voice? Because you feel like it's his voice as an author, his narrative voice, and the voice that gets invested in the inner thoughts of his characters that makes the novel so rich. Mm-hmm. And you don't really – it's hard to adapt a voice to the screen. I mean, the only examples I could really come up with were like, you know, the obvious ones, Stand By Me and Shawshank, which have voiceovers. So they really are working with voice. But usually voiceovers are a disaster, and I feel like they don't seem to work very well in horror movies, especially because it is something that kind of pulls you out of the immediacy of a horror movie experience, you know, that in the moment reaction. And so, like, if I had to sum up, as I tried to do for Rob a couple of days ago, what works about Stephen King and what I think has to be translated, it's still a little abstract, but to me, it's like the fact that Stephen King really genuinely loves his characters as if they're like real human beings and more than that, almost kind of family members. And you have, and a lot of them are fuck ups. You know, I mean, like characters like, you know, Jack Torrance, mm-hmm. You know, Arnie Cunningham and Christine, even Guard in the Tommyknockers. These are like kind of deeply flawed, deeply vulnerable characters. They have really hateful, ugly moments, probably more ugly moments than really sort of positive, redeeming moments. But when it counts, you know, deep down, they sort of have good hearts and they're good people. And I feel like that's sort of how Stephen King sees the world, you know, like the real world and also the world that he creates, this universe he creates and populates with characters that he really loves them and doesn't kind of want to give up on them or, you know, he wants them all to sort of have their shot at redemption. No matter what mistakes they've made. And so there's like, you know, it's sort of like the paradox of, you know, like people who don't like horror movies, why do you want to dwell on, you know, all this ugly stuff and ugly characters and bad things happening in the world? I think there's like this kind of overwhelming warmth in Stephen King's work and in the work of a lot of horror writers that and filmmakers that is like this sort of penetrating light that's completely surrounded by darkness, and like, you know, percentage wise the darkness is overwhelming, but the light sort of never goes out. And so to me, like, that's what you have to capture, and you have to capture that in a film without getting sentimental about it. It's really easy to just get sentimental and hokey about that. And so that's, you know, that to me is kind of the big challenge in adapting Stephen King, which I hope answers your question. I've been rambling so long, I don't even remember what the question was.
No, it does. Do you think that this new adaptation of it is overly sentimental?
Actually, no, I don't think it went too sentimental I think it's actually the filmmaking aspects of the filmmaking that I've sort of talked about that are a little bit obvious to me just from having seen so many horror movies and knowing the story so well. And they're probably things that I'm picking out of it that other people aren't even seeing. And now by doing this podcast, they'll listen and maybe I'll be ruining it for people. But, I didn't feel like it was overly sentimental. I mean, again, the ending worked for me. I thought especially that last scene, it could have very easily gone farther and you know, gotten sort of hokey, and I don't think it did. I thought they sort of ended on the right note without going too far. So yeah, I don't think they fell into that trap.
I hold my breath at the end of most films because those last beats are so important and the last shot is so important. And so when this did the hard cut to black after bye, I just felt so relieved. I was like, oh, you stuck the landing, thank goodness, you know, because again, it works as an ending to this story. Obviously, you know, enough is open-ended that it ends with kind of the blood oath to return if the monster ever comes back, but it works as an ending to this story and then becomes a little bit about what might have been and, you know, young love and heartbreak and all that stuff. So, yeah, I really liked that last scene between Bev and Bill.
And I love it because it feels – it also felt like sort of a hard cut between stories, like that you really can just jump at the very beginning of the next film. You jump right to whatever it is, 27 years later.
Right.
And you just pick up there, and everything that's happened has happened. They don't need a bunch of flashbacks. They don't need, you know, to sort of recap the previous story. They just start. And it has just as hard an opening as this one has, you know, for the ending. It's one story's over, the next story begins, and the next story becomes about having to build kind of to the re-experiencing, not just the remembering, but kind of the re-experiencing of that childhood fear, you know, so that because they have to kind of re-experience it in order to confront it and to fight it. They can't do the easy adult thing, which is just to go, you know, I don't believe in that shit and I'm going to pretend it doesn't exist, because then they're like, then they are everybody else in Derry.
Right.
Just sort of turning a blind eye. And that's what the whole story is about. Is that they're different, but they have to get through that sort of struggle as adults. And one of the things that always sort of fascinated me about the King book that I think isn't really in the mini series at all, that I really hope they're going to hit on when they do chapter two, is you think about like, you know, like you and I having kids, you know, it makes you sort of remember what it's like to be young.
Yeah.
But to really go into the experience, to re-experience sort of the powerlessness and the childhood fears. I mean, we feel as parents who are going, oh God, I can't protect my kid from this. I want to just sue them and I can't. You know, they're still hysterical. I can't fight their nightmares for them, kind of thing. But to go back into actually as an adult, actually having those nightmares and believing the things or questioning the things that you question as a kid, that when you don't know, you know, if the killer clown is real, you can't just go, well, there's no killer clowns, so, you know, forget it.
Right.
You know, to go into that, one of the things that King hits on in his book is just if you can go into that space as an adult and think, really think like a kid, not just remember what it was like to think like a kid, but actually think like a kid, you're running the risk of going mad because it sort of undermines adult rationality. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like the adults in the book are always sort of, they're all kind of courting madness at every turn. And that could really add an element of tension to, you know, to chapter two. That's not even something that exists or can be addressed. It's just not part of chapter one. And so maybe that's their counterpoint to sort of hitting the nostalgia notes is to try to, you know, in their adaptation, figure out what that means and how to present that experience. But again, it is an incredibly tall order, and I think it will require them to get much more sophisticated about their storytelling than they were with this first movie. And maybe I'm stupid for suggesting it, because then maybe they end up making a movie that's not a crowd pleaser. I just know they have to do something different. I don't think they can make chapter two and just keep hitting the nostalgia notes.
Yeah, the cynic in me is afraid that that's exactly what they're going to do, because the movie you're describing, I'm like, oh my God, I'd be so interested in that. But it is so hard. And, yeah. You know, it's
more of a gamble.
Right. You know? And the box office here has taught them, like, well, let's just do that. So people seem to like when we did that. So let's do that. But, you know, in terms of this being a true adaptation of the novel that's going to sit on our shelves forever, yes, of course I want the version that you're describing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you, as you know, you like the movie, do you think, because this has really been touted as, you know, as sort of a new classic horror film. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure that's part of why I'm critical, is I went into this already listening to the hype about how this is the second coming of horror. You know, do you think this, what do you think will be the legacy of this? Will this be, you know, one of the big classic horror films, you know, 10, 20 years down the road?
I think that's just always almost an impossible question to answer, because sometimes I think the movies that we think will be end up sort of becoming forgotten, and new movies kind of spring up that were overlooked in their place. I honestly think so much of it has to do with how well they handle chapter two. I think if they completely botch it, it's going to tarnish the legacy of this movie. If they stick the landing, then I think it might be. I think in terms of, you know, in particular Stephen King adaptations, I think this is going to be mentioned among the best. And I could be totally wrong about that, because I've seen a lot of people saying that online in the last week or so. And I think some of that, again, is just the newness factor of it, the way that I just was talking about this last week. Every time there's a new Pixar movie or a new Marvel movie, you know, everybody has to publish their rankings, and the latest one always ranks pretty near the top because it's the newest one and you haven't lived with it for that long. And so for everybody to immediately announce this as being one of, if not the best King adaptations ever, which I have seen, I think that might be a little premature. I think we need to live with it a little while longer. And I think the second movie is really going to determine how well this one holds up 20 years down the line.
Yeah, I think that's fair. If the second one feels like a real, you know, supplement that can kind of live on its own and maybe even function as a sort of a counterpoint to the first one, I think it'll make them, the first one, more interesting in a way. And I think, I hope at least to bring it back to where I started all this. I hope that the Dark Tower will actually get reassessed, and that if they go ahead and make a series out of it, as they apparently are still planning to do, that it will allow people to kind of look at the, you know, the first movie as sort of part of a whole that works better as a whole. But who knows?
So does the first movie then become sort of like a backdoor pilot to the TV series?
Yeah, well, I think they you know, at least what I always heard was that the you know, it's too big a story, obviously, to tell in movie form. I mean, it's an epic. I forget what is it, like 4,600 pages, I think, the Dark Tower series. You know, there's a lot there, and of course, that's why a lot of people were so angry. Is like the movie's 95 minutes. Are you kidding me?
Right.
But it really was, it was structured, and I think it was actually smartly structured as kind of a launch pad. It functions as kind of a launch pad for a series, and it also kind of functions as a sequel to the books, rather than a true adaptation. So it's this weird kind of middle ground, and if they, you know, go on with a series that works, then I think people will look at it in a different way. I like the way they streamlined it, because I like that, you know, whereas it, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, what you called act two, where you're kind of, you've got to introduce all these characters and each one of them has to have an experience with Pennywise. And it's like a checklist, you know, okay, we've taken care of that kid. He had his experience, and you're kind of going down the list. And then right after that, you have to get them all together going, I've seen the clown too, right, you know? And right. So, like, there's so much that they had to do in a short amount of time. And what, you know, Dark Tower doesn't even introduce all of the major characters. I mean, it really just said, we're going to deal with two, you know, we're going to deal with, well, three, we're going to deal with Roland, we're going to deal with Jake, and we're going to deal with the Man in Black. And it's very streamlined. And so, like, you ended up with this movie that's kind of, it's two things. It's that are a little bit problematic together. It's like mythologically dense in that they were pulling in little bits and pieces and details from all of the books, and not just from the Dark Tower series, but from all of King's books, all these things that resonate if you know that material, but that maybe for somebody who doesn't know it that intimately, it's just kind of like, why did they do that? Why was that there? That was just weird. And you're contrasting that, you know, sort of dense mythology that's there on almost a like subliminal level. You're contrasting that with a story that they made really thematically simple. They sort of picked two notes, other than this sort of like good versus evil battle. They said it's going to be a kind of a father-son story, and it's going to be kind of about Jake as a boy needing to believe in other worlds and sort of the power of imagination for a child. And that really resonated for me. I thought those things, they said, here's the notes we're going to hit, and we've got to kind of trim everything else and save it for later. I thought that really, really worked. It worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, emotionally. I guess it didn't work for anybody else, but, you know, for me, I just went, wow, they hit, you know, the father son thing with Roland and Jake was something that King has always expressed, almost kind of remorse about in the early Dark Tower books. And so there's a bit of kind of revisionist history there where that bond is stronger. And so that worked to me in kind of a sequel to the books way. And the whole power of imagination thing for a kid Jake's age. I mean, I was Jake's age when I read those first three books, and this idea that he's kind of like on like a little scavenger hunt to find keys that will take him into another world that he's seen in his dreams. And he wants to believe it really exists, but of course the adults are telling him it doesn't. That was really powerful stuff for me when I read that. And so to see that on the screen, and that they were really hitting that note and making it such a central part of the storytelling was a big deal for me. I mean, it was like, wow, I never thought I would see that on the screen, and that they would hit that as, you know, kind of the main note to hit. And so it was strange to come home from, you know, I avoided all of the reviews and the trailers and everything, and then I came home, you know, and had pretty much loved it, came home and looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes, and the ratings were worse than Dreamcatcher, and I went, what?
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, it actually had a lower rating than Dreamcatcher, and I felt like I had like slipped into the Twilight Zone for a minute.
All right, two more questions and then I should let you go. First,
okay.
If they, rather when they do chapter two, because I believe it has now already been, greenlit, would you like them to bring back Andy Muschietti as the director, or would you prefer I think they probably will or already are.
I think that's probably a foregone conclusion. Yeah. I think it worked so well. It doesn't feel like, you know, I mean, everybody's, if it works commercially, it works. And right. So there's really no reason to bring in somebody else, unless they just say, look, we've got to do chapter two is kind of a flip side, and so it has to have a different cone, a different tone. I mean, you could still even a director, you know. I mean, I don't know that much about him, but he, you know, it's like a smart director will say, okay, we need to do a different tone. Fine, I'll do a different tone. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to another filmmaker,
right? And then
I'm just bringing him back.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm almost positive they will. And have you, along with the rest of the internet, I believe, given any thought to who you would like to see play the adult versions of these characters?
I have not.
I haven't really either. But
yeah, it's not. I guess that's not something I usually that I usually think about. I mean, even the, you know, it's sort of funny. Again, like I feel like this came up at least briefly in the conversation I had with Rob a few days ago when we were talking a little bit about the Castle Rock series that's coming up.
Yeah.
You know, which characters would you like to see in it? And then, you know, that then begs the question of who's going to play them. I didn't have an answer to which characters I want in Castle Rock. It's just, well, let's see what they do. And you know, I know that now they've cast Scott Glenn, I think, is in it, and Sissy Spacek is in it. And so, you know, I sort of hear the announcements and go, that sounds cool and interesting. And I'm curious to see what they do. You know, the miniseries, I thought had pretty strong actors in the adult roles, but not particularly good performances.
Right. Yeah.
So even if you say I'd like to see this person play the part, you kind of never know what you're going to get. So I tend to just sort of wait and see.
Yeah, that's my approach too, because I feel like fan casting or whatever you want to call it, like you're never really right. You know, like you may think this is who you want to see play the part. But in most cases, no, it isn't. And the person that they end up announcing, you may initially think, oh, I can't quite see that. But again, that's usually where the best surprises take place. Because you don't want to see the character played or performed exactly the way you picture it, because then you're just looking at something play out that you've already imagined a million times. Don't you want to be surprised, and don't you want to see a different interpretation than what you expect it to be, you know?
Right. Well, in fan casting too, I think a lot of it's about,
it's just who looks like, you know?
Yeah. Who looks like it, or you're thinking about some other specific role that they've played and you're going, well, if they play it like that,
right,
that would fit this character in the second part of it. And it's just like, That's not acting, folks. You know, I mean, every part, if you've got a real actor, you know, every part is different, and what they bring to it is going to be different, you know, unless it's like, you know, if you're talking about a, you know, stars, you know, I tend to think of stars and actors as a little bit different, because a star is somebody who's just playing their persona over and over and over again,
right.
You know, without much variation. But, you know, I don't think that chapter two of it calls for stars.
Just needs actors. I mean,
right. So, and I think they'll be mindful of that, just because, you know, stars are expensive, and you've already got this property that's gonna, you know, pack the theaters. So why spend that money on stars?
Right. Yeah. There's really no need to, it would be a mistake really to have a cast that's super heavy on huge names, you know, because again, those people are going to bring their own baggage then into the film as well. I'm fascinated when I see people saying, you know, that so-and-so should play for Bev in particular. It's always, you know, an actress with red hair, as though hair dye doesn't exist. We can only imagine redheads in this role.
Yeah, it's gotta be Julianne Moore. Only Julianne Moore can do it.
Right, exactly. The one I hear a lot, and I get it, is Jessica Chastain. And because she was in Andy Muschietti's first movie, Mama, and so those two have a working relationship, and she's great, and she has red hair, and like, I would be so on board for that. But like, let's just wait until they announce who it's going to be.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, we'll see.
But hey, I don't need to see it. You know.
Well, right, exactly. That's the thing is, I'm so rarely right anyway in terms of I may picture something and then I get something different, and it's almost always better than what I might have imagined, or it's worse, you know. But you won't know until you see it. So,
yeah, different is good.
Yes, I'm all for it. All right. Well, this was awesome. Thank you for talking about this movie with me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Call me the next time there's a new Stephen King movie, which will be well, like 2 weeks.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Because Gerald's Game comes out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, Gerald's Game is the 29th, I think, on Netflix. It's a big year. And then, you know, there's also the ongoing, I guess The Mist is on, and Mr. Mercedes, and 1922 is coming up. I mean, it's crazy. It's a crazy time to be a King fan.
Yeah, it is. I have not been watching Mr. Mercedes, although I will admit that there's an example where they cast Brendan Gleeson, and I thought to myself, that's exactly who I was picturing when I was reading the book, just from the way that character is described. So, but I haven't watched the show.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. I've only watched the first two episodes, so I should qualify that. But it feels kind of real and gritty and like a different kind of King story as the books are. I think it works. The Mist, not so much.
Yeah, I didn't even bother with The Mist, unfortunately.
Yeah. Which was completely unnecessary to begin with. So, I mean, no big surprise, I guess.
Was it just thinking, hey, we could do The Walking Dead, only it's monsters in the mist? Is that the thinking?
I didn't even know if I finished the pilot, actually, because I just kind of went, oh, it's another thing like, you know, like Under the Dome. It didn't feel like very sincere storytelling, and all of the edginess of the film is not there. So it just felt like kind of your standard, you know, Under the Dome or Haven or something like that. And, you know, we're going to kind of milk it for all it's worth, but it just felt like melodrama to me.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, thank you again. This was super fun. Hopefully you didn't ruin the movie for everyone with your...
Sorry. Everybody.
All right. Thank you. And where can people buy your books? On Amazon, right?
Yep. They're around, at least online, kind of wherever you get books, the Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that stuff. And yeah, I stand by Beyond Fear, the Stephen King book. I think it holds up pretty well.
It's a good one. I was excited to, when I was out in LA last summer, I found a copy of Dark Delicacies autographed by you. And I thought, well, that's weird. I'm going to buy a book that he's autographed, but
that kills the value of it. But oh well.
As always, you can find us at fthismovie.com. We're on Twitter at fthismovie, Facebook, Instagram, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, Joe. This was really fun.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.